Matthew stared at him with blank incomprehension. He simply could not understand. It would hurt too much. Your mamma and I had to wait some time for Charles Buford. And for you. And we thought you were both worth the wait, said Father, and even in the midst of horror, he tried to smile for Matthew. This time, Charlotte was hoping for a daughter. Matthew choked on his horror. He thought he might never speak a word or eat another bite. He'd be choking on horror for years. We thought. We were in anticipation. It was entirely clear that Father was certain and had reason to believe his children were his. We were concerned, since you and Charles are both now quite grown up, said Henry. Gideon, good fellow, has been dancing attendance on Charlotte during Clave meetings. He has always stood your mother's friend, lending her the Lightwood name and consequence whenever she needed support, and advising her when she wished for good counsel. I am afraid I never truly understood the workings of an institute, let alone the Clave. Your mamma is a wonder. Gideon had been helping his mother. Matthew was the one who had attacked her. I had thought we might name her Matilda, Father said in a slow, sad voice. I had a great aunt, Matilda. She was very old when I was still a young rip, and the other boys used to tease me. She would give me books and tell me that I was smarter than any of them. She had splendid buttery white wavy hair, but it was gold when she was a child. When you were born, you already had the dearest fair lovelocks. I called her Aunt Matty. I never told you because I thought you might not like to be named for a lady. You already had a great deal to endure with your foolish father and those who cavil at your mother and your parapetai. You bear it all so gracefully. Matthew's father touched his hair with a gentle, loving hand. Matthew wished he'd pick up a blade and cut Matthew's throat. I wish you could have known your great-great-aunt. She was very like you. She was the sweetest woman God ever made, said Father. Save your mother. Brother Zachariah glided in then, a shadow amid all the other shadows crowding that room, to summon Matthew's father to Mother's bedside. Matthew was left alone. He stared in the gathering darkness at his mother's overturned chair, the dropped scone and its trail of crumbs going nowhere, the greasy remnants of breakfast over the disarranged table. He, Matthew, was always dragging his friends and family to art galleries, always anxious to dance through life, always prattling of truth and beauty like a fool. He had run headlong into a shadow market and blithely trusted a downworlder because downworlders seemed exciting, because she had called shadow hunters brutal and Matthew had agreed, believing he knew better than they. It was not the fairy woman's fault, or Alistair's, or the fault of any other soul. He was the one who had chosen to distrust his mother. He had fed his mother poison with his own hands. He was not a fool. He was a villain. Matthew bowed the fair head that had been passed to him through his father, from his father's best-loved relative. He sat in that dark room and wept. Brother Zachariah descended the stairs after a long battle with death, to tell Matthew Fairchild that his mother would live. James and Lucy had come with Tessa and waited in the hall all this long day. Lucy's hands were chilled when she clung to him. She asked, Aunt Charlotte, is she safe? Yes, my darlings, said Jem. Yes. Thank the angel, breathed James. Matthew's heart would break. All our hearts would. Brother Zachariah was not so sure of Matthew's heart after the mischief Matthew had wrought, but he wanted to offer James and Lucy what comfort he could. Go to the library. There is a fire lit. I will send Matthew to you. When he went into the breakfast room, he found Matthew, who had been all gold and laughter, cowering in his chair as if he could not bear what was to come. My mother, he whispered at once, his voice brittle and dry as old bones. She will live, said Jem, and softened, seeing the boy's pain. James had known his parapetized heart better than Jem. There had been a time when Will was a boy everybody assumed the worst of, with good reason, except for Jem. He did not want to learn harsh judgment from the Silent Brothers, or a less forgiving heart. Matthew lifted his head to face Brother Zachariah. His eyes told of agony, but he held his voice steady. "And the child?" Brother Zachariah said, "The child did not live." Matthew's hands closed on the edge of his chair. His knuckles were white. He looked older than he had a mere 2 nights ago. "Matthew," said Brother Zachariah, and walled off his brothers in his head as well as he might.
"Yes?"
"Rely upon a silent brother for silence," said Jem. "I will not tell anybody about the shadow market or any bargains you may have made there." Matthew swallowed. Jem thought he might be about to be thanked, but Jem had not done this for thanks. "I will not tell anybody," he said, "but you should. A secret too long kept can kill a soul by inches. I watched a secret almost destroy a man once, the finest man ever made. Such a secret is like keeping treasure in a tomb. Little by little, poison eats away at the gold. By the time the door is opened, there may be nothing left but dust." Brother Zachariah stared into the young face that had been so bright. He waited and hoped to see that face lit again. "All this about the shadow market?" Matthew faltered.
"Yes," said Jem.
The boy flung back his golden head.
"I'm sorry," said Matthew coldly. "I do not know what you're talking about."
Zachariah's heart fell.
"So be it," he said. "James and Lucy are waiting for you in the library. Let them give you whatever comfort they can."
Matthew stood from his chair, moving as if he had grown suddenly old over the course of a day. Sometimes the distance silent brothers possessed moved them to dispassionate observation and too far from pity. It would be a long time, Brother Zachariah knew, before there could be any comfort for Matthew Fairchild. The library in Matthew's house was a far smaller and less loved and lived-in room than the library in the London Institute, but tonight there was a fire burning and Herondale's waiting within. Matthew stumbled into the room as if he were walking in from midwinter cold, his limbs too chilled to move. As one, as if they'd only been waiting for his coming, James and Lucy looked up at him. They were pressed together on a sofa at the hearth. By firelight, Lucy's eyes were as eerie as James's. Her eyes are paler and more fiercely burning blue than her father's. It was as though James's gold was the corona of a flame and Lucy's blue its burning heart. They were a strange pair, these two Herondales, thorned mysterious plants in the hothouse of the Nephilim. Matthew could not have loved either of them more dearly. Lucy leapt to her feet and ran to him with her hands outstretched. Matthew shuddered away. He realized with dull pain that he did not feel worthy of being touched by her. Lucy glanced at him sharply, then nodded. "She always saw a lot there, Luce."
"I will leave you two together," she said decisively. "Take as long as ever you may."
She reached out her hand to touch his, and Matthew shrank away from her again. This time he saw that it hurt, but Lucy only murmured his name and withdrew. He could not tell Lucy this and see her disgust of him, but he and James were bound. Perhaps James would try to understand. Matthew advanced, every step a terrible effort towards the fire. Once he was near enough, James reached out and clasped Matthew's wrist, drawing Matthew close to the sofa. He laid Matthew's hand over James's heart and covered it with his own. Matthew looked down into James' fire-gold eyes.
"Matthew," said Jamie, pronouncing his name in the Welsh way and with the Welsh lilt that let Matthew know it was meant as a term of endearment. "I am so sorry. What can I do?"
He felt he could not live on with this massive stone of a secret crushing his chest. If he was ever going to tell anyone, he should tell his parapetai.
"Listen to me," he said. "I was talking about Alistair Carstairs yesterday. What I meant to tell you was that he insulted my mother. He said..."
"I understand," said James. "You do not have to tell me." Matthew drew in a small, shaky breath. He wondered if James really could understand.
"I know the kind of thing they say about Aunt Charlotte," said James with quiet fierceness. They say similar things about my mother. You remember that man, Augustus Pounceby, last year? He waited until we were alone to cast slurs upon my mother's good name. A small grim smile curved James's mouth. So I threw him in the river.
Aunt Tessa had been so glad to have a shadow hunter visitor, Matthew remembered numbly. She displayed shadow hunter family coats of arms on her walls to welcome any traveller to the London Institute.
You never told me, said Matthew.
Jamie was telling him now. Tom had told him that whatever Alistair said was nonsense. If Matthew had asked his father about what Alistair had said, his father could have told him about Great Aunt Mattie, and they might even have laughed about how absurd it was to think some stupid, malicious boy could ever make them doubt their family.
Jamie's mouth crooked down a little.
Oh, well, I know you have to hear a lot about me and my unfortunate antecedents already. I do not want you to think I'm an unbearable nuisance, and you got a bad bargain with your parapetai.
Jamie, Matthew said on a wounded breath as if he'd been hit.
I know it must feel wretched to remember anything hurtful that worm Carstairs said about your mother, Jamie plunged on. Especially when she is unwell. The very next time we see him, we will punch him in the head. What do you say to that, Matthew? Let's do it together.
Matthew's father and his mother and his brother and his parapetai had all been trying not to burden him, while Matthew pranced on thinking he was no end of a fine fellow and dealing remarkably by himself. James would not have done what Matthew had, nor would Christopher or Thomas. They were loyal. They were honourable. When someone had insulted Jamie's mother, Jamie had thrown him in the river.
Matthew pressed his palm against James's linen shirt over the steady beat of his loyal heart. Then Matthew clenched his hand into a fist. He could not tell him. He could never do it.
All right, old chap, said Matthew. We will do it together. Do you think I could have a moment alone, though?
James hesitated, then drew back.
Is that what you want?
It is, said Matthew, who had never wanted to be alone in his life, and never wanted to be alone less than in this moment.
James hesitated again, but he respected Matthew's wishes. He bowed his head and went out. Matthew assumed to rejoin his sister. They were both good and pure. They should be together and comfort each other. They deserved comfort as he did not. After James was gone, Matthew could not keep standing. He fell to his hands and knees in front of the fire. There was a statue above the fire showing Jonathan Shadowhunter, the first Shadowhunter, praying for the world to be washed clean of evil. Behind him, the angel Raziel, flying to gift him with strength to defeat the forces of darkness. The first Shadowhunter could not see him yet, but he was standing firm because he had faith.
Matthew turned his face away from the light.
He crawled, as his father had crawled across another floor at the beginning of this endless day, until he was in the darkest and farthest corner of the room. He had not believed. He laid his cheek against the cold floor and refused to let himself weep again. He knew he could not be forgiven. It was long past time for Brother Zachariah to return to the City of Bones. Tessa stood with him in the hall and touched his hand before he went.
The sweetest woman God ever made, he had heard Henry say earlier.
Jem loved Charlotte, but he had his own image of the sweetest this world could offer. She was always his anchor in cold seas, her warm hand, her steadfast eyes, and it was as if a flame leaped between them and a mad hope. For a moment, Jem was as he had been. It seemed possible to be together in sorrow, united as family and friends were, to sleep under the Institute roof and go down in the morning to breakfast, sad but safe in the warmth of a shared hearth and human hearts. He thought, yes, ask me to stay.
Goodbye, Tessa, he said.
He could not. They both knew he could not. She swallowed, her long lashes screening the shine of her eyes. Tessa was always brave. She would not let him take a memory of her tears back to the Silent City, but she called him by the name she was always careful not to call him when anybody but they could hear. Goodbye, Jem. Brother Zachariah bowed his head, his hood falling about his face. and went out into the winter cold of London.
"Finally you leave," said Brother Enoch in his mind.
All the silent brothers hushed when Brother Zachariah was with Tessa, like small animals in the trees hearing the approach of that which they did not understand. In a way, they were all in love with her, and some resented her for that. Brother Enoch had made it clear he was tired of two names ceaselessly echoing in their minds. Brother Zachariah was halfway down the street where the Fairchilds lived when a tall shadow struck his across the pale streets. Brother Zachariah looked up from shadow and saw Will Herondale, head of the London Institute. He carried a walking stick that had once been Zachariah's, before Zachariah took a staff into his hands.
"Charlotte will live," said Brother Zachariah. "The child never had a chance to."
"I know," said Will. "I already knew. I did not come to you for those tidings."
"You should really have learned better by now. Of course Tessa would have sent word to Will, and while Will often traded upon Brother Zachariah's position as a silent brother to command his services and thus his presence, he very seldom spoke to Zachariah of his duties as a silent brother, as if he could make Zachariah not what he was by dint of sheer determination. If anyone could have done it, Will would have been that one. Will threw him the walking stick, which he must have stolen from James's room, and confiscated Brother Zachariah's staff. Jem had asked them to give James his room at the Institute, fill it with their son's bright presence and not keep it as some dreary shrine. He was not dead. He had felt when they made him a silent brother as if he had been cut open and all things inside him ripped out. Only there was that which they could not take away.
"Carry it a while," said Will. "It lightens my heart to see you with it. We could all do with lighter hearts tonight."
He traced a carving upon the staff, the Herondale ring winking by moonlight.
"Where shall I carry it?"
"Wherever you please. I thought I would walk with you a little way, my Parapetai."
"How far?" asked Jem. Will smiled.
"Need you ask? I will go with you as far as I possibly may."
Jem smiled back. Perhaps there was more hope and less sorrow in store for Matthew Fairchild than he feared. None knew better than Jem that someone could be not fully known yet still entirely loved, forgiven all sins and dearest in darkness. James would not let his Parapetai travel any shadowy paths alone. No matter what catastrophe came, Jem believed the son had as great a heart as his father. New streetlights showed Will's and Jem's silhouettes, walking together through their city as they had of old, even though both knew they must part. Across London, the bells rang all together in a sudden, terrifying clamour. Frightened birds in mad, wheeling flight cast deeper shadows across the city at night, and Jem knew the Queen was dead. A new age was beginning.
Every exquisite thing.
This one was stained with something purple. This one had a hole in the sleeve. This one was missing a back, an entire back. It was just the front of a shirt and two sleeves clinging on for dear life. "Christopher," Anna said, turning the garment over in her hands, "how do you do these things?" Everyone had their small wonderland. For her brother Christopher and Uncle Henry, it was the laboratory. For Cousin James and Uncle Will, the library. For Lucy, her writing desk, where she wrote her long adventures for Cordelia Carstairs. For Matthew Fairchild, it was any troublesome corner of London. For Anna Lightwood, it was her brother's wardrobe. In many ways, it was very good to have a brother who was largely oblivious about his clothes. Anna could have taken Christopher's coat right off his back and he would hardly have noticed. The only downside was that Christopher's clothes had suffered fates no clothes should suffer. They were dipped in acids, brushed by fire, poked with sharp objects, left out in the rain. His wardrobe was like a museum of experiment and disaster, tattered, stained, charred, and stinking of sulfur. To Anna, though, the clothes were still precious. Christopher was over visiting the Institute and Uncle Henry, so he would be gone for hours. Her mother and father were both out in the park with her baby brother, Alexander. This was her golden hour, and there was no time to waste. Christopher was taller than her now and growing all the time. This meant that his older trousers suited her frame. She chose a pair, found the least damaged shirt and a passable grey-striped waistcoat. She dug through the pile of ties, scarves, kerchiefs, cuffs and collars that lay on the bottom of Christopher's wardrobe and selected the most passable items. On his dressing stand, she found a hat that had a sandwich in it. It was ham, Anna noted, as she tipped it out and dusted out the crumbs. Once she had everything she needed, she bundled it all under her arm and slipped out into the hall, shutting his door quietly. Anna's room was so different from her brother's. Her walls were papered in a dusty rose. There was a white lace coverlet, a pink vase with lilacs next to her bed. Her cousin Lucy thought her bedroom quite charming. Anna had different tastes. Given her choice, the paper would be a rich, deep green, her decor black and gold. She would have a deep chaise longue on which she could read and smoke. Still, she had a long dressing mirror that was all that mattered right now. Christopher's mirror had met its fate in an experiment in which he attempted to magnify the effect of glamours. It had not been replaced. She drew the curtains against the warm summer sun and began to change. Anna had long forsworn wearing a corset. She had no interest in squeezing her internal organs into a lump or pushing her small bosom up. She slipped out of her tea gown, letting it drop to the floor. She kicked it away. Off went the stockings, down came the hair. The trousers were tucked in at the ankle to adjust for height. A few adjustments of the waistcoat hid the damage to the shirt. She put on one of his black ascots around her slender neck and tied it expertly. Then she took the derby that had been hosting the ham sandwich and placed it on her head, tucking her black hair carefully up under it and arranging it until it appeared that her hair was shorn short. Anna stood before the mirror examining the effect. The waistcoat flattened her chest a bit. She tugged it up and adjusted it until the fit was right. She rolled the legs of the trousers and knocked the hat down over her eye. There. Even in these clothes, stains and ham sandwiches and all, her confidence swelled. She was no longer a gangly girl who looked awkward in ribbons and flounces. Instead, she looked elegant, her lean body complemented by more severe tailoring, the waistcoat nipping in her slim waist and flaring over her narrow hips. Imagine what she could do with Matthew Fairchild's wardrobe. He was a real peacock, with his colourful waistcoats and ties and the beautiful suits. She walked back and forth a bit, tipping her hat to imaginary ladies. She bowed, pretending to be taking the hand of a fair maiden, keeping her eyes turned up. Always keep the fair maiden's eyes as you press your lips to her hand. Enchanted, she said to her imaginary lady. Would you care for a dance? The lady would be delighted to dance. Anna crooked her arm around the waist of her phantom beauty. She had danced with her many times. Though Anna could not see her face, she swore she could feel the fabric of her lover's dress, the soft swooshing noise it made as it brushed the floor. The lady's heart was fluttering as Anna pressed her hand. Her lady would wear a delicate scent, orange blossom perhaps. Anna would press her face closer to the lady's ear and whisper, "You are quite the most beautiful girl here," Anna would say. The lady would blush and press closer. "How is it you look more lovely in every light?" Anna would go on. "The way the velvet of your dress crushes against your skin. The way your..." "Anna?" She dropped her airy companion to the floor in her surprise. "Anna?" her mother called again. "Where are you?" Anna hurried to her door and opened it just a crack. "Here," she said in a panic. "Can you come down, please?" "Of course," Anna replied, already pulling at the ascot around her neck. "Coming!" Anna had to step right through her fallen dancing partner in her haste. Off with the waistcoat, the trousers, everything. Off, off, off. She shoved the clothes into the bottom of her wardrobe. The discarded dress was hastily put back on, her fingers fumbling on the buttons. Everything about girls' clothing was fussy and complicated. Several minutes later, she hurried downstairs, attempting to look composed. Her mother, Cecily Lightwood, was sifting through a stack of letters at her desk in the sitting room. "We ran into Inquisitor Bridgestock while we were walking," she said. "The Bridgestocks have just arrived from Idris. They've asked us to dine with them this evening." "Dinner with the Inquisitor," Anna said. "What a thrilling way to spend an evening." "It is necessary," her mother said simply. "We must go. Can you keep an eye on Christopher while we are talking? Make sure he doesn't set anything on fire or anyone." "Yes," Anna said automatically. "Of course." It would be a dreadful affair. Clave business accompanied by overcooked beef. There were so many other things she could be doing on a fine summer night in London. What if she could walk the streets finely dressed, a beautiful girl on her arm? Someday the lady would not be imaginary. The clothes would not be borrowed and ill-fitting. Someday she would stride down the street and women would fall at her feet, not failing to notice her perfectly polished brogues. And men would tip their hats to a lady killer more accomplished than they. Just not tonight. It was still sunny when the Lightwood family got into their carriage that evening. There were costermongers out, and flower sellers and bootblacks, and so many lovely girls walking in their light summer dresses. Did they know how lovely they were? Did they look at Anna and see the way she looked at them? Her brother Christopher bumped gently against her as they rode. "This seems like a long route to the Institute," he noted. "We're not going to the Institute," Anna said. "Aren't we?"
"We're having dinner with the Inquisitor," her father said.
"Oh," Christopher said. And with that, he was off in his own thoughts, as ever, inventing something in his mind, working out a calculation. In this, Anna felt close to her brother. They were both somewhere else in their minds at all times. The Bridgestocks lived in Fitzrovia, just off of Cavendish Square. Theirs was a fine three-across townhouse. The paint on the shiny black door looked like it could have still been wet, and there were electric lights outside. A servant showed them in to a dark and close reception room where the Inquisitor and his wife greeted them. They took little notice of Anna, except to say what a charming young lady she was. She and Christopher sat politely on stiff chairs and added a decorative element to a dreary occasion. The dinner gong finally sounded, and everyone shuffled through to the dining room. Anna and Christopher were seated at the far end of the table, and there was an empty place set across from her. Anna ate her asparagus soup and stared at a painting of a ship on the wall. The ship was in the throes of a storm, the masts on fire, and on the verge of disintegrating into the sea.
"Did you hear they're building a portal in the guard?" the Inquisitor asked Anna's parents.
"Oh dear," Mrs. Bridgestock said, shaking her head. "Is that a good idea? What if it were to let demons through?" Anna envied the ship in the painting and all who sank in her.
"Of course," the Inquisitor droned on. "There's also the matter of money. The Consul has rejected the proposal to create an official currency of Idris. A wise decision.
Very wise.
As I was saying earlier."
"I'm so sorry for my lateness," said a voice. In the doorway of the dining room stood a girl, probably Anna's age, in a midnight blue dress. Her hair was jet black like Anna's, but fuller, more luxurious, deep as night sky against her soft brown skin. But what captured Anna were her eyes, eyes the color of topaz, large, the lashes thick.
"Ah," the Inquisitor said, "this is our daughter, Ariadne. These are the Lightwoods." "I was meeting my tutor," Ariadne said as a servant pulled out her chair. "We were delayed, I do apologize. It sounds like I came in just as you were debating the new currency. Shadowhunters are an international group. We must blend seamlessly with many international economies. Having our own currency would be a disaster."
On that, she plucked her napkin and turned to Anna and Christopher and smiled. "We have not met," she said. Anna had to force herself to swallow, then to breathe. Ariadne was something beyond the realm of humanity or Shadowhunter. The angel himself must have made her. "Anna Lightwood," Anna said. Christopher was pushing peas onto the back of his fork, unaware that a goddess had seated herself across from him. "And this is my brother, Christopher. He can be a bit distracted." She gave him a nudge. "Oh," he said, noticing Ariadne. "I'm Christopher." Even Christopher, now that he had seen Ariadne, could not help but be mesmerized by her. He blinked, taking in the sight. You're not English, are you?" Anna died several deaths inside, but Ariadne simply laughed. "I was born in Bombay," she said. "My parents ran the Bombay Institute until they were killed. I was adopted by the Bridgestocks in Idris." She spoke very plainly, in the tone of someone who has long accepted a set of facts. "What killed your parents?" Christopher asked conversationally. "A group of Vettis demons," Ariadne said. "Oh, I knew someone at the academy that was killed by a Vettis demon." "Christopher," Anna said. "You go to the academy?" Ariadne asked.
"Not anymore. I caused one of the wings to explode."
Christopher took a bread roll from a plate and happily began buttering it. Anna looked at the painting of the ship again, trying to will herself onto the deck and then into the black, pitiless waters. The most lovely girl in the world had just walked into her life, and in 30 seconds her dear brother had managed to bring up the death of her family, a death at school, and the fact that he had blown up part of the academy. But Ariadne was not looking at Christopher, even as he inadvertently placed his elbow into the butter dish. "Have you caused any explosions?" she asked Anna. "Not yet," Anna replied. "But the evening is young." Ariadne laughed, and Anna's soul sang. She reached over and lifted her brother's elbow from the butter, never taking her gaze from Ariadne. Did she know how beautiful she was? Did she know her eyes were the color of liquid gold, and that songs could be written about the way she turned out her wrists to reach for her glass? Anna had seen beautiful girls before. She had even seen a few beautiful girls who looked at her the way she looked at them, but that was always in passing. They went by on the street, or their gaze lingered a bit long in a shop. Anna had practiced the art of the prolonged stare, the one that invited them. "Come, tell me of yourself. You are lovely." There was something in the way Ariadne was looking at Anna that suggested... No, Anna had to be imagining it. Ariadne was being polite and attentive. She was not eyeing Anna romantically over the dinner table, over the roasted potatoes and the duck. Ariadne's perfection had caused Anna to hallucinate. Ariadne continued to contribute to the conversation at the other end of the table. Anna had never been so interested in the economic policies of Idris. She would study them night and day if she could join Ariadne in discussing them. Every once in a while, Ariadne would turn back to Anna and look at her knowingly, her mouth twisting in a smile like a bow. And each time this happened, Anna would wonder again what was happening and why that particular look made the room spin. Maybe she was ill. Maybe she had developed a fever from looking at Ariadne. The pudding came and went, and Anna vaguely remembered eating it. As the dishes were cleared and the women stood to leave the table, Ariadne came and hooked her arm through Anna's. "We have quite a good library," she said to Anna. "Perhaps I could show it to you?" Anna, with a show of supreme self-control, did not immediately fall to the floor. She managed to say, "Yes, the library, yes, she would love to see it. Yes, library, yes, yes." She told herself to stop saying she wanted to see the library and looked over at her mother. Cecily smiled. "Go on, Anna. Christopher, would you mind accompanying us to the greenhouse? Mrs. Bridgestock has a collection of poisonous plants that I think you will quite enjoy." Anna cast Cecily a grateful look as Ariadne led her from the room. Her head was full of Ariadne's orange blossom perfume, and the way her tumble of dark hair was pinned up in a gold comb. "It's this way,"
Ariadne said, leading Anna to a set of double doors toward the back of the house. The library was dark and had a chill. Ariadne released Anna's arm and illuminated one of the electric lights. "You use electricity," Anna said. She had to say something, and that was as good a thing as any. "I convinced Father," Ariadne said. "I am modern and possessed of all sorts of advanced notions." The room was full of crates, and only some of the books had been unpacked and shelved. The furniture, however, had been placed. There was an ample desk and many comfortable reading chairs. "We're still settling in here," Ariadne said, sitting herself prettily. She had no other way, on a deep red chair. Anna was too nervous to sit and paced along the opposite side of the room. It was almost too much to look at Ariadne here in this dark, private place. "I understand your family has a very interesting history," Ariadne said. Anna had to speak. She had to figure out a way to be around Ariadne. In her mind, she donned her real clothing. The trousers, the shirt, the mental one had no stains, the fitted waistcoat. She slipped her arms through the sleeves. Thus attired, she felt confident. She managed to sit opposite Ariadne and meet her gaze. "My grandfather was a worm, if that's what you mean," Anna said. Ariadne laughed aloud. "You didn't like him?" "I didn't know him," Anna said. "He was quite literally a worm." Clearly, Ariadne didn't know that much about the Lightwoods. Usually, when one's demon-loving relative develops a serious case of demon pox and turns into a giant worm with massive teeth, word gets around. People will talk. "Yes," Anna said, now examining the gilded edge of a writing desk. "He ate one of my uncles."
"You are funny," Ariadne said to Anna. "I'm glad you think so," Anna replied.
"Your brother's eyes are quite extraordinary," Ariadne noted. Anna heard this a good deal. Christopher's eyes were lavender in color.
"Yes," Anna said. "He's the good-looking one in the family."
"I quite disagree," Ariadne exclaimed, looking surprised. "Gentlemen must compliment you all the time on the shade of your eyes." She blushed and looked down, and Anna's heart skipped a beat. It wasn't possible, she told herself. There was simply no chance that the Inquisitor's beautiful daughter was like her. That she would look at another girl's eyes and note their color as lovely, instead of simply asking her what fabric she wore to bring out their shade best.
"I'm afraid I am quite behind on my training," Ariadne said. "Perhaps we could train together?"
"Yes," Anna said, maybe too quickly.
"Yes, of course, if you..."
"You may find me clumsy." Ariadne twisted her hands together.
"I'm sure I won't," Anna said. "But that is the point of training in any case. It is a delicate thing, training, despite the obvious violence, of course."
"You'll have to be delicate with me then," Ariadne said, very softly. Just as Anna thought she might faint, the doors opened and Inquisitor Bridgestock came in with Cecily, Gabriel, and Christopher in tow. The Lightwoods looked vaguely exhausted. Anna was conscious of her mother's eyes on her, a sharp and thoughtful look.
"And we have our map collection. Ah, Ariadne. Still in here, of course. Ariadne is a fiendish reader."
"Absolutely fiendish," Ariadne smiled. "Anna and I were just discussing my training. I thought it would be sensible to partner with another girl."
"Very sensible," Bridgestock said. "Yes, very good idea. You should be partners. Anyway, Lightwood, we'll look at the maps at some point. Now, Ariadne, come into the parlor. I'd like you to play the piano for our guests."
Ariadne looked up at Anna. "Partners," she said.
"Partners," Anna replied.
It was only on the way home that Anna realized that Ariadne had asked her to the library and not shown her a single book. "Did you like young Ariadne Bridgestock?" said Cecily as the Lightwood's carriage rumbled home through the dark streets of the city.
"I thought her very amiable," said Anna, looking out the window at London sparkling in the vast night. She longed to be out there among the earthbound stars, walking in the streets of Soho, living a life of music and adventure and dancing.
"Very pretty, too." Cecily tucked a stray lock of hair back behind her daughter's ear,
In surprise, Anna looked at her mother for a moment. There was a little sadness in Cecily's eyes, though she couldn't have guessed why. Perhaps she was simply tired after being bored by the Inquisitor all night. Papa, for instance, was quite asleep in the other corner of the carriage, and Christopher was leaning against him, blinking drowsily. "She isn't nearly as pretty as you." "Mother," Anna said in exasperation, and turned back to the carriage window. Under the arches of the railway viaduct near the south end of London Bridge, a large gathering was taking place. It was midsummer, so the sun set over London at nearly 10 o'clock. This meant the time to sell at the Shadow Market was reduced, and the whole place had a bit of a frenzied air. There was steam and smoke and flapping silks. Hands reached out, shoving wares under shoppers' noses. Gems and trinkets, books, pendants, powders, oils, games and toys for downworlder children, and items that could not be classified. There was a hum of smells. The tang of the river and the smoke from the trains overhead mixed the remains of the day's produce from the mundane market. Squashed produce, bits of meat, the odour wafting from oyster barrels. Vendors burned incense which tangled with spices and perfumes. The miasma could be overpowering. Brother Zachariah moved through the crush of stalls, immune to the smells and the crowding. Many downworlders drew back at the approach of the silent brother. He had been coming here for weeks now to meet Ragnar Fell. Tonight he also glanced around to see if he spotted the vendor he had seen on one of his previous visits. The stall he was looking for could move on its own. It had feet like a chicken. The woman behind it was an elderly fairy woman with a wild mass of hair. She sold colourful potions, and Matthew Fairchild had purchased one and given it to his mother. It had taken all of Jem's efforts to bring Charlotte back from death's door. She had not been the same since, nor had Matthew. The stall was not present tonight, nor, it seemed, was Ragnar. He was about to take a final turn around the market before departing when he saw someone he knew bent over a stall of books. The man had a shock of white hair and striking purple eyes. It was Malcolm Fade.
"Is that you, James Carstairs?" he said.
"How are you, my friend?" Malcolm simply smiled. There was always something a little sad about Malcolm. Jem had heard gossip about a tragic love affair with a shadow hunter who had chosen to be an iron sister rather than be with the one she loved. Jem knew that for some, the law was more important than love. Even as he was now, he could not understand it. He would have given anything to be with the one he loved. Anything except that which was more sacred than Jem's own life. Tessa's life, or Will's.
"How goes your quest?" said Malcolm. "Has Ragnar turned up any information for you about a certain demon you've been seeking?"
Jem gave Malcolm a quelling look. He preferred that not too many people knew of the quest he had undertaken.
"Malcolm, I have the book you wanted."
A warlock woman carrying a book bound in yellow velvet strode up to Malcolm.
"Thank you, Leopolda," said Malcolm.
The woman stared at Jem's face. Jem was used to this. Though he was a silent brother, his lips and eyes had not been sewn shut. He did not see or speak as humans did, but the fact that without runes he could have done so seemed to distress some people more than the sight of a silent brother who had bound himself less reluctantly to the quiet dark.
"We have not met."
"No," the woman replied, "we have not.
My name is Leopold Stein. I make a visit here from Vienna."
She had a German accent and a soft purring voice.
"This is Brother Zachariah," Malcolm said.
She nodded. There was no hand extended, but she continued to stare.
"You must forgive me," she said. "We do not often see silent brothers in our market. London is a strange place to me. The market in Vienna is not so bustling. It is in the Wienerwald, under the trees. Here you are under this railway. It is quite a different experience."
"Zachariah is not quite like other silent brothers," said Malcolm.
Leopolda seemed to conclude the study she was making of Jem's face and smiled.
I must bid you good night, she said. It is good to see you, Malcolm. It has been too long, mein Liebling, too long. And it has been most interesting to meet you, James Carstairs. Auf Wiedersehen.
She slipped away through the crowd. Jem watched her go. She decided to call him James Carstairs, not Brother Zachariah, and the choice seemed deliberate. There were certainly many denizens of Downworld who knew his Shadowhunter name. It was no secret. But suddenly Jem felt like a butterfly under a pin, caught in the gaze of the lepidopterist.
Can you tell me about her? He asked Malcolm, who had returned to examining the book in his hand.
Leopolda is a bit of an odd one, Malcolm said. I met her while I was travelling in Vienna. I don't think she leaves her city often. She seems to get around with some famous mundanes. She is... He hesitated.
Yes?
More connected, I suppose, to her demon side than her human side than most of us are. More than me, certainly. She makes me feel uneasy. I'm glad that you came over. I was looking for a way to politely escape.
Jem looked in the direction that Leopolda had gone. Someone more connected to the demon side. That was someone he might need to speak with. Or watch.
Anna lay in her bed, eyes closed, trying to will herself to slumber. In her mind, she was dancing again. She wore her imaginary finest evening wear, a suit of deep grey, a waistcoat of sunny yellow with matching gloves. On her arm was Ariadne, as she had been tonight, in the blue dress. Sleep was not coming. She pushed herself out of bed and went to the window. The night was warm and close. She had to do something with herself. Her brother's clothes were still in the wardrobe. She picked them out and smoothed them on the bed. She had planned on returning them, but who would miss them? Not Christopher. Their laundress might, but no one would question that Christopher might simply lose his trousers, possibly in the middle of a crowded dance floor. And the older clothes? He wouldn't need them, not at the rate he was growing. The trousers were too long, but they could be hemmed. The shirt could be nipped in at the back. A few simple stitches were all it would take. Anna was not a natural seamstress, but like all shadow hunters, she possessed the basic skills to repair gear. She couldn't have made lace or done precise tailoring, but she could get this job done. She tacked his shirt and waistcoat in the back to make them fit and flatter her torso. The jacket was a bit more complex, requiring tucks on the back and the side. The shoulders were a bit wrong and the effect a bit triangular, but all in all, it was a passable effort. She practiced her walk in the fitted trousers, now that they no longer scraped the ground. She had always loved gear as a child. Its easy maneuverability, the way it allowed her to move unfettered. She'd always been surprised that other girls, unlike her, didn't resent being pressed back into dresses and skirts when training was over, that they didn't resent the loss of freedom. But it was more than the comfort of the clothes. In silks and ruffles, Anna felt silly, as if she were pretending to be someone she was not. When she wore dresses out on the street, she was ignored as a gawky girl, or stared at by men in a way she did not like. She had only been out in her brother's clothes twice, both times late at night. But oh, women looked at her then, smiling women, conspiratorial women, women who knew that in donning the clothes of men, Anna walked in their power and their privilege. They looked at her soft lips, her long eyelashes, her blue eyes. They looked at her hips in tight trousers, the curve of her breasts under a man's cotton shirt, and their eyes spoke to her in the secret language of women. You have taken their power for your own. You have stolen fire from the gods. Now come and make love to me, as Zeus made love to Danae in a shower of gold. In her mind's eye, Anna bent down to take Ariadne's hand in hers, and the hand seemed real. You are so beautiful tonight, she said to Ariadne. You're the most beautiful girl I have ever seen. And you, Ariadne answered in her mind.
are the most handsome person I have ever known. The next day, Anna spent 2 hours writing a note to Ariadne that ended up reading, "Dear Ariadne, it was very nice to meet you. I hope we can train together sometime. Please do pay a call. Regards, Anna Lightwood." 2 entire hours for that, and a pile of drafts. Time no longer had meaning and might never have meaning again. In the afternoon, she had plans to meet her cousins, James, Lucy, and Thomas, along with Matthew Fairchild. James, Matthew, Thomas, and Christopher were inseparable and always meeting at a house or a hideout. They were invading her aunt Sophie and Uncle Gideon's home today. Anna only attended their little gatherings on occasions, as did Lucy. The girls had many occupations to amuse themselves with. Today, she desperately needed something to do, something to moor her mind in place, to keep her from fighting and pacing her room. She walked with Christopher, who was excitedly talking of some kind of device that would fly through the air by means of 4 rotating blades. It sounded like he was describing a mechanical insect. Anna made noises that indicated she was listening, although she was most assuredly not. It was not far to their cousin's house. Her cousins Barbara and Eugenia were in the morning room. Barbara was stretched out on the sofa, while Eugenia was furiously working at a bit of needlepoint as if she truly hated it, and the only way she could express her hatred was by stabbing the stretched cloth with the needle as vigorously as she could. Anna and Christopher went up to the rooms that had been claimed for the group. James was there, sitting on his window seat, reading. Lucy was sitting at the desk, scribbling away. Tom was throwing a knife at the opposite wall. Christopher greeted everyone and immediately went to the corner that was reserved for his work. Anna dropped down next to Lucy. "How's Cordelia?" she asked. "Oh, she's wonderful. I was just writing to her quickly before Thomas helps me go over my Persian lesson." Lucy was always writing to her future parabatai, Cordelia Carstairs. Lucy was always writing. Lucy could write in a room full of people talking, screaming, singing. Anna was sure that Lucy could probably write in the middle of battle. Anna approved of this highly. It was very good to see two girls so devoted to each other, even platonically. Women should value other women, even if society often did not. Ariadne came into her mind again. "What's wrong, Anna?" James said. He was looking at her curiously. Anna loved all of her cousins, but she had a very soft spot for James. He had been a somewhat awkward young boy, gentle and quiet and bookish. He'd grown up into a young man Anna could see was extraordinarily handsome, like his father. He had a soft fall of Herondale black hair. From his mother, he had inherited his demonic trait, his inhuman golden eyes. Anna had always thought they were rather pretty, though Christopher had told her that James had been teased relentlessly at the academy because of them. It was the teasing that prompted Matthew to get the explosives, and Christopher to arrange for a wing of the building to blow up. It was honourable to defend your friends, your parabatai. Anna was proud of them for doing it. She would have done the same. James had been such a shy, delightful little boy. It made Anna furious to think that he had been mocked. He was older now, given a bit more to brooding and staring into the distance, but still kind under it all. "Nothing," she said. "I just need a new book to read." "A most sensible request," James said, swinging his long legs off his reading perch. "What sort of book? Adventure, history, romance, poetry?" All the younger set were fearfully bookish. Anna put it down to Uncle Will and Aunt Tessa's influence. They seldom let one leave the Institute without a book they felt one simply must read. Now that they were talking about this, perhaps this would be useful in talking to Ariadne. She was a fiendish reader after all. "I'm training with someone new," Anna said. "Her name is Ariadne. She does quite a lot of reading, so..." "Ah, Ariadne. That's a name from mythology. We could start you on a course of that. Would you like to begin with The Golden Bough by Fraser? There's a new edition of 3 volumes, unless you want to start with the basics. There's always Lamprière's Bibliotheca Classica." James flipped gracefully through the books on the wall. He was an accomplished fighter and excellent dancer.
Perhaps it was these traits combined with the fact that he was growing into his looks that explained why he seemed to suddenly be so popular with girls. He couldn't walk through a room without them sighing and giggling. Anna supposed she was pleased for him, or would be if he ever noticed it was happening. He had soon plucked a dozen books from the shelf, passing one to Christopher almost as an afterthought. A silver bracelet flashed upon his wrist as he held his arm out. A love gift, Anna wondered? Perhaps one of the sighing gigglers had attracted his interest after all. Anna supposed she ought to be more charitable toward them. She felt herself on the verge of sighing and giggling over Ariadne at any moment. The door flew open, and Matthew Fairchild entered the room and draped himself dramatically over the back of a chair.
"Good afternoon, you wonderful bunch of villains.
James, why are you clearing the shelves?"
"Anna asked me for something to read," James said, surveying a table of contents with a furious eye. He set the book aside.
"Anna, reading? What dark magic is this?"
"I am hardly an illiterate," Anna said, throwing an apple at him. He caught it easily and smiled. Matthew was normally very fastidious. He and Anna often spoke of gentlemen's fashion together. But today Anna noticed that his hair was a bit wild, and one of the buttons on his waistcoat was undone. These were small things, to be sure, but on Matthew they spoke of something larger.
"What is your interest?" Matthew asked.
"Is it a crime to want to become more literate?"
"Not at all," Matthew said. "I love literature. In fact, I found a marvellous place. It's a salon full of writers and poets, but is a bit disreputable."
Anna cocked her head in interest.
"Here we go,"
James said, bringing over a pile of a dozen or so books and setting it down with a heavy thump. "Do any of these appeal? Have a look and see. Of course, I can recommend others. Wait, no, not these. Not these." He scooped the books away and returned to the shelves. James was clearly absorbed in his task. Christopher was happily reading his book, which had a horribly scientific title. Lucy and Thomas were at the desk, Thomas helping Lucy go over some phrases. Lucy was learning for Cordelia, and Tom liked languages, since he spoke Spanish with Uncle Gideon and Welsh with his cousins. Angel blessed their sweet, studious souls. None of them seemed likely to hear Anna and Matthew hatching a dark plot. Nevertheless, Matthew pitched his voice very low. "Why don't I come and get you at midnight?" Matthew said. "We can go together. I could use a companion who knows how to have a bit of fun. You might need a disguise, though. No reputable young lady walks the streets of London at midnight."
"Oh," Anna said. "I think I can manage something."
Just before midnight, as promised, Anna heard a tapping at her bedroom window. Matthew Fairchild was there, dancing along the edge. Anna threw it open.
"Oh, my, he said approvingly. "Are those Christopher's?"
Anna had dressed herself in her brother's clothes. The sewing had helped a good deal. "A disguise," she said simply. He laughed, spinning carelessly on the sill. She could see he had been drinking. His reflexes were slow, and he only caught himself a half second before tumbling back out to the ground.
"They suit you better than they suit him, but still, we need to get you something nicer than that.
Here."
He pulled the ascot from his neck and handed it to her.
"I insist," he said. "I can never let a lady go out in inferior menswear."
Anna felt herself exhaling slowly and smiling as she put on the tie. The two of them jumped from her window, landing noiselessly on the courtyard in front of the house. "Where is this place?" Anna said.
"A nefarious corner of Soho," he said with a smile.
"Soho?" Anna was delighted. "How did you find out about it?"
"Oh, just through my wanderings."
"You do a lot of those."
"I have a periphrastic soul."
Matthew was more drunk than he had first appeared. He rolled back on his heels and spun around the occasional lamppost as they walked. He had been like this a lot in recent weeks. What was fun and light about Matthew had taken on an edge. On some level, she felt a bit of worry rising. But this was Matthew, and he did not do well under confinement.
Perhaps the summer night had just gotten his spirits particularly high. The house Matthew took Anna to was deep in the warren of Soho, off of Brewer Street. It was painted black with a green door.
"You'll like it here," Matthew said, smiling at Anna.
The door was opened by a tall, pale man in a maroon frock coat.
"Fairchild," he said, looking at Matthew.
"And Fairchild's good friend," Matthew replied. Anna could feel the intelligence of the vampire's gaze as he took her in for a long time. He seemed intrigued, both by her and by Matthew, though his expression was unreadable. At last, he stepped aside and allowed them in.
"You see," Matthew said, "no one can resist our company."
The hall was utterly dark. The fanlight had been covered in a velvet drape. The only light came from candles. The house was decorated in a style that Anna thoroughly approved of. Heavy green paper run through with gold, velvet curtains and furniture. It smelled of cigars and strange, tiny rose-coloured cigarettes and gin. The room was crowded with a mix of downworlders and mundanes, all elaborately dressed. Anna noticed many people taking in the sight of her in her men's clothing and nodding appreciatively. The men seemed pleased or amused, the women either admiring or interested. Quite a few raked Anna boldly with their eyes, their gazes clinging to the feminine body revealed by her fitted clothes. It was as if, in casting off dresses, she had cast off society's expectation of a woman's modesty and could allow herself to be admired, desired. Her soul soared with new confidence. She felt herself a gorgeous creature, neither a gentleman nor a lady. A gentlewoman, she thought, and winked at one of the only people she recognized, the werewolf, Wolsey Scott, head of the Praetor Lupus. He wore a bottle-green smoking jacket and was puffing away on a hookah pipe while holding court for a cluster of fascinated mundanes.
"Of course," Anna heard him say. "They had a difficult time getting my bathtub into one of the tree houses, but I would hardly leave it behind. One must always bring one's own bathtub." "That's somebody-somebody Yates over there," Matthew said, indicating a tall, bespectacled man. "He read a new work the last time I was here."
"And it was wonderful," said a voice. It came from a woman sitting near where Matthew and Anna stood. She was a stunning warlock with the scaled skin of a snake, coloured silver, almost opalescent. Her long green hair tumbled over her shoulders and was strung through with a fine gold mesh. She wore a red gown that clung to her frame. She tipped her head up elegantly toward Matthew and Anna.
"Are all London shadowhunters so handsome as you?" she asked.
She had a German accent.
"No," Anna said simply.
"Definitely not," Matthew agreed.
The warlock smiled.
"Your London shadowhunters are more interesting than ours," she said. "Ours are very tedious. Yours are beautiful and amusing."
Someone grumbled something at this, but the rest of the group laughed appreciatively.
"Do sit and join us," the woman said. "I am Leopolda Stain."
Most of the people around Leopolda seemed to be fawning mundanes like the group around Wolsey Scott. One man wore a black robe covered in symbols Anna did not recognize. Matthew and Anna sat down on the rug, against a pile of tasseled pillows that served as a sofa. Next to them was a woman wearing a gold turban scarf pinned with a sapphire.
"Are you two of the Chosen?" she asked Matthew and Anna.
"Certainly," Matthew said.
"Ah, I could tell from the way Leopolda reacted to you. She is quite wonderful, is she not? She is from Vienna and knows simply everyone, Freud, Mahler, Klimt, Schiele."
"Marvelous," Matthew said. He probably did think it was marvelous. Matthew adored art and artists.
"She's going to help us," the woman said. "Obviously, we've had such troubles here. Why, Crowley wasn't even recognized here in London. He had to go to the Ahator Temple in Paris to be initiated to the grade of Adeptus Minor, which I'm sure you heard about."
"The moment it happened," Matthew lied.
Anna bit her lip and looked down to keep herself from laughing. It was always amusing to meet mundanes who had fantastical notions of how magic worked. Leopolda, she noticed,
was smiling indulgently at the entire group, like they were adorable but somewhat dim-witted children.
Well, the woman continued, I was an adept of the Isis Urania Temple, and I can assure you that I was adamant that... This was interrupted by a man standing in the middle of the room and raising a glass of something green.
My friends, he said, I demand that we remember Oscar. You must raise your glasses.
There was a general noise of agreement, and glasses were raised. The man began to recite Oscar Wilde's The Ballad of Reading Gaol. Anna was struck by one of the stanzas.
Some love too little, some too long. Some sell and others buy. Some do the deed with many tears, and some without a sigh. For each man kills the thing he loves, yet each man does not die.
She didn't quite know what it meant, but the spirit of it haunted her. It seemed to have an even more pointed effect on Matthew, who slumped down.
It is a rotten world that will allow a man like Wilde to die, Matthew said.
There was a hardness in his voice that was new and a bit alarming. You're sounding a bit dire, Anna said.
It's true, he replied. Our greatest poet, and he died in poverty and obscurity not so long ago. I threw him in jail because he loved another man. I do not think love can be wrong.
No, Anna said. She had always known that she loved women the way that she was expected to love men. That she found women beautiful and desirable, while men were good friends, brothers in arms, but nothing more. She had never pretended otherwise, and her close friends all seemed to accept this about her as a known fact. But it was true that though Matthew and the others often joked with her about slaying the hearts of pretty girls, it was not something she and her mother had ever talked about. She recalled her mother touching her hair fondly in the carriage. What did Cecily truly think of her odd daughter? Not now, she told herself. She turned to the woman in the turban who had been trying to get her attention.
Yes? My dear, the woman said. You must be sure to be here in a week's time. The faithful will be rewarded, I promise you. The ancient ones, so long hidden from us, shall be revealed.
Of course, Anna said, blinking. Yes, wouldn't miss it for the world. While she was simply making conversation, Anna found that she would like to return to this place. She had come here dressed as she was, and she had received only approbation. In fact, she was sure that one of the vampire girls was examining her with a look that was not entirely wholesome. And Leopolda, the beautiful warlock, had not taken her eyes from Anna. Had Anna's mind and soul not been full of Ariadne? Well, it could only be left to the imagination. As Matthew and Anna left the house that night, they did not notice a figure across the street standing in the shadows. Jem recognized Matthew at once, but was confused at first as to who was with him. The person resembled his parabatai, Will Herondale. Not Will as he was now, but Will at 17, with his confident swagger and upturned chin. But that could not be. And the person was obviously not James, Will's son. It took him several minutes to realize that the young man was not a young man at all. It was Anna Lightwood, Will's niece. She had inherited the dark hair and the profile from the Herondale side of her family, and clearly she had inherited her uncle's swagger. For a moment, Jem felt a pang in his heart. It was like seeing his friend as a young man again, as the two of them had been when they lived at the Institute together and fought side by side, as they had been when Tessa Gray first arrived at their door.
Was it really so long ago?
Jem shook the thought loose and focused on the present. Anna was in some sort of disguise, and she and Matthew had just been at a Downworlder gathering with a warlock he had come to observe. He had no idea what they were doing there. A full week passed. A full week of Anna running for the post, looking from the window, walking partway to Cavendish Square before turning back. A lifetime. It was agony. And just as it was turning to acceptance, Anna was called downstairs early Friday morning to find Ariadne waiting for her in a yellow dress and a white hat.
Good morning.